Yesterday,
I introduced for a general theory involving a scalar field, three generating functional. So we start from a quantum theory.
Scalar field phi(x), action, a classical action, which is general case, one after d phi, with phi, some local potential, and we introduce the generating function or the correlation function, the general products, expectation value of products of fields operator, which is written as a functional interval minus one of the h bar action, the action of phi. And I'm working the Euclidean setting. But changing this by a factor I over h bar and changing the action with a metric, the Minkowski metric, works as well. Okay. So this is a generating functional for correlation functions. Okay. We have seen, or at least I have heard, that if you define another generating function, which I denote W of G, oh, I'm sorry, of course, I forgot the very important term, which is minus the source term, G dot phi. G, function. So it's a classical function of the field. And we use it as a parameter to generate the correlation functions. And here. Okay, so W of G is defined just as h bar times the logarithm of Z of G. And here I am keeping track of the h bar. And finally, this is the generating function for the connected functions. So the quantity given by restricting to the sum of Feynman diagrams which are connected in perturbation theory. And finally, I introduced a third generating functional, which is a function of a classical which is defined out of G of J, the source term, J, by, and then I need not to make mistakes about times by G dot phi minus W of G. Okay. With phi defined as a function of J of the source term by phi equal, so more or less, more precisely, phi of x, the value of this classical phi field at a given point x as the functional derivative with respect to the source term J at this point x of W of phi. Of W of G. Okay. But not setting J equal to zero. So basically, this is the expectation value of the quantum field, this phi at the point X, in the theory where J is not set to zero. So it is this expectation value obtained by this functional integral. Okay. So this classical field phi is a function of the source term. And what we do that here is that we define gamma by this combination, and then we make change variables. So instead of considering phi as a function of j, we consider that j is a function of this var phi. So this is, we just make a change of coordinate. So this classical field, in fact, is denoted a background field. And it's a background field because it's the average value of the quantum field. So it's a field which is viewed by a classical particle interacting with this quantum field. Imagine that you have a very massive field, which is described by very massive particles, which is coupled to this quantum field. Well, basically, this massive particle will behave as a classical particle. And what this particle is going to see during its dynamical evolution is not the detail of the quantum field, but its expectation value, its average, its quantum average at a given point in space, time. Because all the quantum fluctuations are average at much smaller wavelengths and much smaller time scale than the scales in time, in space-time, which is probed by a very massive particle.
So that's hence the name background field, which is very important. That's a standard terminology.
Okay. And this is an abstract definition. It corresponds to what is called the Legendre transform. So we go from W to gamma by what is called in mathematics the Legendre transformation. And in fact, you can invert this equation and show that W is an inverse Legendre transform of gamma. It's going to be useful. Okay. And what I stated yesterday is that gamma of phi is the generating functional for the irreducible correlation functions. Namely, the correlation function obtained by summing over subpart of Feynman diagrams, which are what is called one particle irreducible, or in fact, one PI. Those are the diagrams that stays connected if you remove anything, any arbitrary propagator, which are the building blocks of perturbation theory. Okay, so that's. So I won't give a complete proof of this statement, but it can be, you can find in textbook and part of it in my lecture notes. But what I'm going to show is to show first an explicit expression for gamma order h bar. So I'm going to see that what is the form of this effective potential or this effective action. This is the effective action. Action. While this is a classical action, what is its form at first order in the quantum effects? It's called the semi-classical And
I'm going to show how from this form you recover.
When you get recover the one loop diagram for the 542. Okay, so first, what do we mean by something of order h bar? So let us come back to ordinary perturbation theory as it is defined from where is that? From this generating functional. But if you again bring back the h bar factor in perturbation theory, it's easy to see that you see each factor proportional to J is J divided by H bar phi. So it means that in the diagrammatic rules of Feynman, when you have an external vertex which is associated with factor G, J, in fact, there is factor J over H bar. So there is factor H bar to the power minus one associated to an external vertex. Right. Similarly, if for instance, for the 5-4 theory, V is 5-4, then you have for internal vertices are four legs vertices because they are associated to factor 5-4 times G. But in fact, it's 5-4 times G divided by H bar. So there is a factor of H bar minus one associated also to the internal vertices. And finally, the propagator is the inverse of the kinetic part divided by H bar. So propagator, you see, is the inverse of the quadratic part, which contains a factor H bar. It's H bar divided by P squared plus M squared in the momentum space. So for the propagator. And from this, when you look at how many H bar factors are associated to a given Feynman diagrams, well, you check, for instance, that the free propagator, there are two external vertices, no internal vertices, and a H bar. And since, so it's a H bar minus two times H bar, but in W of G, there is factor H bar here. So you see that for connected diagrams, there is an additional H bar factor, which comes from just from the definition of W of G. This gives a sum of, this gives the connected diagrams with this rules, and you multiply the amplitudes of any diagram by H bar. So for any connected diagram, you have an H bar factor. So this comes out from H bar minus two times H bar for the propagator times H bar factor. So this is H bar zero. Right. The same for this diagram. If you compute, you have H bar minus four times H bar minus one times H bar times H bar times H bar times H bar times H bar. So this is H bar zero. And now if you consider this diagram, you count and you find that it's H bar to the power one. Same for this diagram. H bar 1. And for instance, for this diagram that I drew yesterday, which is a 4-point diagram, there is a factor H bar 2.
Professor?
Yes.
Yes, I had a question. Yeah. So to clarify, so this H bar is actually not the H bar, right? It's a formal parameter of expansion.
Yeah, no, this, I'm doing calculation. So H bar is a formal, here it's a parameter. And in actual calculation in a quantum theory or in a problem of quantum physics, or even in, you know, in condensed matter, in quantum condensed matter, H bar takes the value it takes in nature. Of course, but here we consider it just as one of the parameter, like c, the speed of light, which is set to one because we normalize time and the space unit so that it's one, or like the gravitational constant, Newton's constant.
Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, we set h bar to one and then only introduce it in front, right? Because if we had h bars in the action, like other h bars, the limit would be spoiled, right?
Yeah, no, here consider I'm doing math and I'm looking at how H-bar appears in actual calculation. In fact, you can always set system of units where H-bar is equal to one in a calculation. But of course, it won't be meters, seconds, joules or ergs, whatever. It will be another, you know. But you can set H-bar into equal to one in some fancy system of unit, which makes calculation simpler. But here, H bar is just the parameter which occurs in the calculation. Okay.
So you see that these diagrams have no H bar. These diagrams have one H bar. These diagrams have two H bar.
So it means that if you are computing some physical process where compared to the units of action, the typical units of action which are present in the system, H bar is small, then quantum effects are small. And we are doing to a semi-classical approximation. We can perform a semi-classical approximation. So there are physical problems where the quantum effects are small and H-bar in the proper system of units is small. So you can consider what's happening at first order H-bar, second order of H-bar, etc. And in that sense, we can speak of a semi-classical approximation. Of course, there are regimes where quantum effects are very important. And then it means that in the correct unit of systems characteristic for this physical system, H bar is over the one. So you cannot disentangle quantum effects from classical effects. But here H bar is a parameter in my calculation. Okay, so let me continue. So you see here that when you do this calculation, you remark that these diagrams are trees. These diagrams are one internal loop here. Here there is one loop. Here you have two loops. So when you sum over momenta, internal momenta, when doing calculation of Feynman amplitudes of the Feynman integrals associated to diagram, you have to integrate over some internal momenta. And that's a general feature. In fact, when you have a connected diagrams, the power of H bar that appears from this diagram is H bar to the power, the number of loops. Number of loops of the diagram. Here it's zero, here it's one, here it's two. And the reason from that is a basic theorem of topology. You see that this power, what is this power? It's minus the number of vertices.
of the diagram, because you see that vertices carry a factor of h bar minus one, plus the number of lines of the diagram, plus one, but one is the number of connected components of the diagram. So it's the number of connected component of the diagram. And there is a basic theorem of topology, of graph. Which just states that this combination is equal to the number of loops. Or, if you prefer to reverse, minus the number of vertices. Well, plus the number, move this here and move this here. The number of vertices minus the number of lines plus the number of loops equals the number of connected components. And it's a theorem of topology of graph because this is the number of zero dimensional component. This is the number of zero dimensional component points minus the number of one dimensional component, the lines, plus the number of two dimensional component of the graph, which are those faces. You have a face here, you have a face here, you have a face here, you have a face here. And this is what is called in mathematics the first Betti number of the graph, which is precisely the number of connected components. So it's a theorem of topology of what? So there is topology behind this simple result. And you see that according, following this theorem, the power h bar is the number of loop in any diagram. So often the expansion, the perturbative expansion in h bar is called the loop expansion. And that's a generic terminology in quantum field theory and also in string theory and in quantum gravity, because it's very general. We have not used the fact that we are dealing with the 5-4 theory. You can check that the same thing for QED or more complicated theories. Okay, so here we are going to the first order in the loop expansion. Okay, so how can we prove this theorem? So this, this way. Okay, so I think I just need that the perturbative expansion is h bar to the number of loops. I just need this result. So let me erase this. And what I'm going to show, well, let me consider this theory. You see, the action, I can consider the action of phi, which is just you associate a number to a field configuration. Now you can, so it's a function over the space of field configuration. Now you can consider the first derivative of this function with respect to variation of the field. So you consider an object which you consider as prime of phi, and in fact it's a function, it depends on the position, it's just the functional derivative of the action with respect to phi at a given point x. So this is what I call the first derivative of the action. It's a gradient of the function of the action with respect to variation of the field. And now you can consider the second derivative of phi, which is obtained by taking two derivatives of the action with respect to variation of field at two different points. So it's a function of 2 points, x and y. See? So this is what is denoted the second derivative of the action. It's a function of 2 points, and in fact, it's, you can consider this as a kernel of an operator acting on functions, like the propagator in general, because you can consider that given some function f of x, you can apply this object to the function f and compute its value at the point x. And this is defined simply by the convolution integral dy y times f of y. So in fact, this object is an operator. It's a kernel of an operator acting on functions. It's just the usual convolution function.
Okay. And now,
if you consider this action here, S of phi, then what is S prime of phi? S prime of phi is just minus delta of x of phi plus V prime of phi x. It's a function of x, which is just the Laplacian of the function phi at a given point x, plus the function, the derivative of the function g prime at the function phi of x. So for phi 4, it is going to be phi cube. Phi 4, this is going to be phi equals minus delta phi plus g divided by 3 phi cubed. Now, what is the operator second derivative of the action? Well, you derive once again with respect to phi. So you get an operator here. You get the operator minus delta, the Laplacian, which is an operator acting on functions, plus just the function, which is the second derivative of phi at a given point x. So basically, this is an operator. This is a number times the identity. So this is a differential operator. And that's just multiplication of a function by v double prime of phi at the point x. So this is an operator. This is an operator. And this is a function of x. You obtain the function s prime phi at a given point x by taking the Laplacian minus the Laplacian of the function phi at the point x and adding plus g divided by factorial 3 phi cube at the point x. Okay, so of course, for phi 4, what you get is minus delta plus what I divide once more, so I get g divided by 2 phi squared. Oh, I'm sorry. There was, of course, a mass. I forgot the mass. G divided by C cube, and this is M square. That's the operator which appears in the free propagator, plus G divided by 2 times 5 cube. Okay, so that's important. We are going to need those expressions.
When we take the primes and double primes, why doesn't the operator change? Because in the first when we take the primes and double primes, why doesn't the first operator change? Because you are taking functional derivative with respect to
delta is an operator, and the coefficient of this operator, if you're the matrix element of the Laplacian, do not depend on the function phi.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an operator, which is a linear operator with constant coefficients, acting on the vector phi of x. So when you take the derivative with respect to phi of x, you just take the derivative of this phi.
Okay.
So you get the operator minus the Laplacian.
Okay.
You know, you can write this a bit in more detail, but thinking about writing the kernel of the operator of the Laplacian, which is going to be just a Laplacian of a Dirac delta function, mm-hmm. write everything in terms of
Dirac
delta function and their derivative, and everything works fine.
Okay.
So I've just been a bit sketchy and quick, but yeah. You can trust me. Okay, so this is for the theory whose potential is in fact for V of phi equal m squared over 2 phi squared plus G divided by factor of 4 phi 4, where this is the action. This is the first derivative, and this is the second derivative of the action. Okay, so now, what I'm going to show is somehow a theorem, or at least a very classical result, which is valid for any action. It is that when I consider the effective action for the classical background field var phi, it can be expanded in powers of h bar, because it's given by a sum of Feynman diagrams, and some diagrams have no loop. They give the h bar zero term. Some diagrams have one loop. They give the h bar term. Some diagrams have two loops. They give the higher order term in the semi-classical expansion, etc. Okay. So the result is that the leading order, where no h bar, is just the action, the classical action of the theory, estimated for this background field. Okay, then you get an h bar correction, and this h bar correction has a very simple form. It's 1/2 of the log of the determinant of this operator, the second derivative of the action, estimated for the value for the chosen background field, var phi. So from the action S, you take the second derivative, you get this operator. Well, it's an operator acting on functions. But if you are careful, you can compute what is the determinant of this operator. Well, it requires a bit of care because of a short distance divergence. But if you work on the lattice, everything works fine. So you get the determinant. Then you take its log, the log of a determinant. The determinant is a number, so you can take its log. Well, you normalize by 1/2, and this is the coefficient of order h bar. And it's a very general formula. And then you have a fourth higher loop terms over the H bar that can be computed, but I'm not going to discuss them today or in this lecture. It would take too much time. Okay, so this is a very general formula. Because it's valid for basically any action. So it's any S of phi. Okay? For any scalar fields. So it's not restricted to phi, to the term with a phi 4 interaction term. Moreover, it can be generalized to gauge fields, vector fields, spin 1. Well, to tensor fields with spin 2, for instance, to to the gravitation theory. This formula is useful in doing semi-classical calculation in quantum gravity. And it's also valid for fermions. You have fermions. Spin 1. Ah. But just with an important caveat, because spinors, spin 1/2 fields are fermions, they obey to the Dirac statistics instead of the Bose-Einstein statistics. They obey to the Fermi-Dirac statistics. And this sign plus 1/2 is changed into a sign minus 1/2. But we are going to see that when quantizing the Dirac field. Okay. So now, of course, you can try to prove this formula. In fact, you can prove such a formula using the canonical quantization formalism for a given theory with a given interaction. But in fact, it's much easier to prove this formula, I think, in the using functional integral, because everything is very simple. And to prove this formula, I have to use an elaborated version of the saddle point approximation in the functional integral. So let me give the details are given in my in the course, but in the lecture notes. But so I'm going to give the main steps. So we keep. Assume that you have in mind the definition of gamma of phi. And well, I'm going to use that again. How to prove this formula? So first, I start from this C of G. Well, I just write this integral Z of phi exponential minus 1 over h bar, the action of phi minus g times phi. Okay. And now I consider that h bar is small. Because I'm doing a semi-classical expansion. So if h bar is small, I can estimate this formula by using the saddle point approximation. Saddle point approximation. Which means that what dominates in this exponential is a point where S of phi minus G phi is minimal, so that the exponential is maximum. So we look for extrema and maximum, in fact, the extrema, an extremum of S of phi and G phi, G being fixed. Because this is a function of G, of J, I'm sorry, J fixed. J fixed, I look for an extremum of this. Well, an extremum is a point where the derivative of this functional of phi vanishes. So the extremum is given by some given, how, let me do just of phi C. That's a critical point, which is a functional of G, which is given by the equation. So that the first derivative of the action with respect to a variation of phi. So this is the derivative with respect to phi of the action. The derivative with respect to phi of this term is minus G. Is equal to zero, you see. So in fact, this means that I take the function S prime phi at a given point X minus J at a given point X, and it gives zero. So it gives phi C as a function of J. So this is a bit, you know, abstract, but you can compute it for the specific action of phi four. Then you have to solve that. S prime, oh, this is the phi q here. You have that this term has to be equal to G. So you see that phi satisfies a nonlinear partial differential equation with a phi cube term. So in some sense, it's a nonlinear Schrodinger equation for phi, the phi four theory. And therefore, so phi C is given by the solution of this equation. So S prime at phi for phi C is equal to minus G. Okay. And then you have to compute this integral by computing just the contribution of the integral when phi is close to phi C, which is a function of G. So we get a phi C. Phi C is a function of J. Okay, so now to compute this integral, we just write that the general phi is phi C, which is a function of J, plus small variation. Let's call them phi tilde. And the smaller h bar, the smaller the variation have to be. Because the integral, this is some kind of Gaussian integral, which is peaked at phi C. So in fact, phi is of order h bar 1/2. You get an integral in the phi level, which is peaked at phi C, something like that. And if h bar is small, you can just use the quadratic approximation. Keep only the term which are of order phi tilde square. And the other one will be negligible. And if you do that, this is just called the saddle point approximation. What you get is that V of G is just, well, the contribution of the saddle point. So it's exponential of minus 1 over h bar s of phi it's C minus P I C. That's the contribution of the saddle point. And then you have the contribution over the integral, the fluctuation, but you are now integrating a Gaussian So you just get a determinant of the quadratic form. And what you get is just the determinant of the operator given by the second variation of the action, but estimated at the saddle point here to the power minus 1/2. It's just Gaussian integration. You see? So we just use the property of Gaussian integrals. Okay. So, and of course, in fact, if you do the calculation more precisely, you are going to find higher order correction in H bar, but for H bar small, they are negligible. So this is an estimate which is solid when H bar is very small. You have a term which is exponential of minus 1 over H bar, and then you have a number which is going to represent the quantum, the effect of the quantum fluctuation, fluctuation of phi around the saddle point, which describes the classical physics. So this is the classical, this term is classical. And this term represents the quantum effects in the semi-classical approximation. Okay, so now once we have that, well, we can easily compute. Well, let me raise the picture. We can compute obviously W of J. W of J is just h bar times a log. So we compute the log of that. So what is the log of that? The log of that is minus 1 over h bar times this.
The, yes. In this expression of Z,
yes,
means we have computed only till h bar power 0 or something, right? Means it's not yet.
It's not the full answer, except for the free field theory, because for the free field theory, the action is Gaussian, so there are no correction to the quadratic term. So this result is exact for the free field.
Yeah, but the
approximation.
Yeah,
the interaction terms. Yes.
Means my question is that the term that we got outside the bracket, what is the dependence of h bar there? Is it only in the exponential or in the determinant also?
No, no. So you see, this equation, there is no h bar in this equation.
Okay.
The further dependence in h bar is in the higher order.
Okay.
Calculation where it computes this integral beyond the Gaussian approximation in the vicinity of the of the saddle point.
That means I was just thinking because we expanded our field phi as phi c plus some, we put some power of h bar there with phi tilde. So does that
expand? No, but you know, we integrate over. It's just to show that, so you can find this like that. And you integrate with phi tilde. So you perform the functional integral, but you keep only the terms in this exponential, which are of order phi tilde squared.
Yeah.
And forget about the term which could be of order phi tilde cube, phi tilde to the power 4, etc.
Yeah, only my confusion was that whether that h bar with h phi tilde comes up somewhere in the integration. Because
phi tilde you integrate over. So if you want to really control, you use this, you write phi c as phi c plus h bar 1/2 phi tilde, because then you see that the phi tilde that count have order 1.
Yeah, okay. Means, yeah, maybe. So
when you integrate over phi tilde, you get some numbers. And if you integrate something which is h bar times some function of the phi tilde, then you get the integral of phi tilde gives some numbers and you get the power of h bar in front of that.
Yeah.
So that's the usual trick to control the approximation. But
okay, got it.
That's the idea. Okay. Okay. So Let's compute W of G. It's, remember, it's h bar times the log of W. So this is what? This is G pi C minus S pi C plus h bar times the log of this. So plus, so it's, and plus, you have a determinant to the power minus 1/2. So we get minus h bar over 2 times the log of the determinant of the operator, which is the second derivative at phi c.
Okay.
So we have an explicit expression for W of G, where remember phi c is a function of G given by this equation. Okay. So it's something which is complicated in J, because phi c is a function of J. Now we can perform the Legendre transform. By defining the background field bar phi as the functional derivative of W of J with respect to variation of J. So in order to do that, you have to compute, of course, this requires knowing how phi c
depends on J.
Requires relation. What is the variation of functional derivative of phi c
with respect to J? Well, it turns out that the solution, there is something very simple. What you found is that
phi of x is just phi c of g plus term of order h bar.
That's a result of a simple calculation.
Okay, because basically, you can take the variation of this with respect to J, you get some equation, and you can check that this is what you get from the equation of phi c.
So basically, at leading order h bar, the background field
is equal to the saddle point.
First order in H bar.
Okay.
So now, and the details are given in the code, but I won't have time to give. So just look at the notes or redo the calculation. Well, the proof is contained on page, yeah. Okay, and now you can perform the Legendre transform, because remember,
you know that gamma of phi of bar phi is just g phi minus W of g. And so this is G times phi minus phi c,
bar phi minus phi c, which is a function of phi,
plus s phi c plus h bar over 2, determinant of the second derivative phi c. Log determinant. Sorry. Okay. So here you see that you have phi c, you have phi c, and you have, here you have the background field minus phi c. And the background field bar phi is equal to phi c plus some term over the h bar. And if you walk a little bit, you show that this equation, this term and this term, if you use this equation, you can check that this becomes just S of R phi. In other words, if you expand this and try to estimate what is the difference between S of phi c and S of R phi, it is given by this term. So this term cancel with the variation. You can replace this by phi c. Okay? Are no correction of order h bar. And then, of course, this term here is already a term over h bar. So we have a term over h bar times a term over the one. And in this term, if you replace phi c here by phi, you are going to get a difference in the log determinant of order h bar. So times h bar, the difference is of order h bar squared. So in this term, you can replace this by h bar over 2 log determinant of the second derivative of the classical action estimated at the bound plus term over h bar squared. So the big delicate term is to show that this term becomes this term. And this is easy. And once the calculation is terminated, it's finished, what you get of this nice formula. So that's the idea. So I skipped some of the detail, but basically the important point is to go from there to there to show that this is equal to this plus some terms of order h bar square. Okay, so this is a very general theorem, and well, I'm almost done, but let me just say that without again going into any detail, for the phi 4 theory, let me estimate what is log determinant of this object. So back to phi 4. Back to phi 4. For phi 4 theory, if we want to estimate the one, the h bar one term in the effective action, we have to estimate log of the determinant of this operator, the second derivative of the action. But the second derivative of the action, we computed it here. It's minus the Laplacian plus n squared, which is the operator for the quadratic form associated to the free field, plus g over 2 times phi squared. And we can we can rewrite this determinant as the determinant of this operator times the operator 1 plus g over 2 times the inverse of this operator times var phi square, where this is a function. Okay? And you know that the log of a product of two determinants is equal to the product of the determinant. It's a bit
formal because we are dealing with infinite dimensional determinant. But so you can rewrite this as log determinant of sine theta m squared. So it's a product, and the log of a product is the sum of the log. So we get log of determinant of this operator plus the log of the determinant of this operator. Okay. But there is another formula which is very useful, which is, you know, that the log of a determinant of a matrix is equal to the trace of the log of the matrix, where you define the log of the matrix in the standard way. So you can rewrite this as trace of the an operator which is the log of this operator plus trace log of 1 plus g over 2 minus delta plus m squared and pi squared. Log trace of a log of a determinant. And this determinant is 1 plus an operator times a function applied to the function. So this is a function. This is a determinant times a function with a factor of g. So now, if we want to come back to perturbation theory, you can expand, consider this term, expand in the coupling constant g, considering that the coupling constant is small. Again, we come back to perturbation theory. And you know that the log of a 1 plus 6 is x minus x squared over 2 plus x 3 divided by 3 minus 30. It's just a Taylor expansion of log of 1 plus 6. So you can express this trace of log as simply sum from k equal 1 to infinity of what? 1 over k, g over 2 to the power k, times the trace of the product of k times this operator, minus delta plus n squared times 5 to the power k. So you have trace of the power of an operator. And now,
should that be an inverse?
What?
Should there be an inverse there?
Yeah, no, this is inverse. Okay. So now, what is this operator?
Dan, if you give me 1 minute.
This operator, what is this operator? Yes, this one. Minus delta plus m squared minus 4 times pi squared. It's an operator. So it's an operator which has a kernel. And this, its kernel is something very simple. It's just the kernel of minus delta plus m squared. Minus 1, so this is the kernel of this operator. It's just the free propagator. Considering the, you know, the matrix element xy of this operator, it's the kernel of this. So it's a free propagator. And here you multiply by a function, which is pi squared of 1. The value of the background field at the point y. And now when you take the trace of the power k of this operator, well, you multiply those operators, you make convolution of those operators,
you close because you take a trace. So you take the kernel from you see from x1, this operator, this operator, x2, then you take the kernel from x2 of the operator to x3, up to the kernel from xk minus 1, the operators to xk. But since you take the trace, you take the diagonal x1 element. And since you make convolution, it means that you integrate over all the points. Well, no, this is xk. xk, x1. And so you have functions and you have the propagator. So you can represent this object by just a Feynman diagram. Oh, you don't have to integrate. Yes, no, no, you have to integrate. So you have a Feynman diagram where you have propagators going from x1 to x2 to x3 up to xk. Here you have three propagators. And at each point here, you associate phi squared of x1, phi squared of x2. So you associate two phi with no propagator. So for, so it means that this is a one loop diagram. Of the five-fold theory. And for instance, the first term for k equal one is just this diagram, because you have only an x1, and here you have phi of x1, phi of x1. At order two, you get this diagram, you have two x1 and x2. At order three, you have three diagrams, you have a diagram which is a triangle, here you have four diagrams. Yeah. Well, you have factors, why did I draw this? K and two to the power K. And what you discovered in, is that in fact, this formula contains just the sum of all one group diagrams. Four. So by just doing using this formula, which we obtain by functional integral calculation and using the saddle point approximation, writing explicitly what is the second derivative of the action for the phi four, making a perturbative expectation of G, we recover the Feynman diagram, the irreducible one. Diagram of phi to the four without using the Vick theorem. So,
could you explain what did you write in the big diagram to the left before the perturbation?
This one?
Yeah.
Well, this is just this diagram over the K. So, it's a way to represent, if we represent the propagator here, by the propagator going from x to y, then this is the propagator from x1 to x2 times phi squared of x1. Here, the propagator phi squared of x2 times the propagator from x2 to x3, then phi squared of x3 times the propagator from x3 to x4, etc., etc. So it's just a diagrammatic representation. Of this trace.
Got it.
Okay. Well, I
don't have time to. I can return to that, or you can ask me some questions. But
the details are contained in the notes. So if you go if you have problems, just go carefully through the notes and you'll find all the details with the correct factor. And you can check that the factor, you know, the factor in front, this k, this 1 over k times 2 to the power k, is just a symmetry factor given by the Feynman rules. So that's one way to show, dealing just with an irreducible diagram, how functional integral methods and this effective action construction allows to recover the Feynman diagrammatic rules. Okay, so I'm sorry for not having enough time to give details, but this would require 2 lectures. I can, if you, I can go back if some of you are troubled next Monday. Okay, and I'm going to manage to download updated lecture notes on the website. I basically didn't have time to do that, but there is a bit of more of material that I've added on the perturbation theory. And maybe next Monday I will, I have to think about it, but maybe I will talk about something else, which is related, which is called the Schwinger-Dyson equation. Shortly, which is another way also to consider perturbation theory. But we'll see on Monday. In any case, I have not changed the part that I've been discussing today and the previous 2 lectures. So you can rely on those notes if you want to understand. Okay. Well, thank you. And see you next week.